Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It is Tuesday, June 3rd. Proposed budget cuts have reached high up into the summit of Mauna Kea. We'll have a reaction to the decision by the National Science Foundation not to fund the 30-meter telescope. A surprise announcement, Honolulu Police Chief Joe Logan is to retire at the end of the month. Plus, we go along on a homeless count in Waikiki in the wee hours of the morning, from the main thoroughfares to the back alleys of the urban core down to the beaches. And remember the Golden Girls? A new play plays homage to the popular television classic. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The unexpected decision by the National Science Foundation to cut funds for the 30-meter telescope is a setback for the project on Mauna Kea. A statement released by project manager Feng Chuan Lee says, "We are disappointed the NSF budget request does not include TMT, but we remain firmly committed to finding a path forward for TMT." But Native Hawaiian groups who oppose the 30-meter telescope are hailing this latest development. Community leader Heolani Sonotapale, who is with the Kalahui Hawaii, is hailing the decision, calling this the beginning of the end.
I think this is a great news. It's the beginning of the end for 30-meter telescope. And this will, I think, give a lot of hope to Kia'i who have been kind of waiting. It's been very quiet the last few years, but people haven't stopped working on this issue. There's a lot of Mauna Kea Kia'i working to address the issue of the 30-meter telescope and whether or not it's going to go forward. Right now, a lot of focus, I mean, in the last couple of years, was on the National Science Foundation funding, along with other things, like whether or not the fact that they do have an actual construction permit and if that has expired. So there's a lot of angles that Kia'i and protectors of Mauna Kea have actually taken up. But with the National Science Foundation, you know, they were supposed to make a decision on what project they were going to fund, and they kept delaying it. So it's been a couple years, and this is really good news. But it doesn't seem very final. They just said that they won't move to the next step. And there could be other funding sources as well for the 30-meter telescope. But it seems that the 30-meter telescope is coming up upon many obstructions in terms of being able to move forward. There were countries that pulled out from this project. I believe Canada pulled out. So this is just another obstacle for them that they're facing. I just have to thank all of the people who sent in request to be part of the Section 106 consultation process for the National Science Foundation under the National Historic Preservation Act. There were actually hundreds of people that emailed the National Science Foundation last year asking to be part of this review, which would have taken months, years to complete with so many people involved. This is a great, great victory for Mauna Kea Kia'i, and long term, this is just awesome that it's being stopped, you know, because the long-term fight, some people have been in this fight, like Kealoha Piscota, for 20 years plus. And it's not just one thing. It's going to be a whole list of things that's going to actually be the death of this project. But this is the beginning of the end, I feel, because the NSF was supposed to provide more than half of the project's funding. Letters went out to the National Science Foundation from hundreds of people saying that the proposed project to be built on Mauna Kea would have substantial and significant and adverse cumulative impacts on this sacred mountain. So it wouldn't have been in their best interest to go forward with 30-meter telescope, because if their funding has been cut and they really are in dire straits in terms of funding, then I think for them it looked like the Magellan Telescope was going to be a better investment.
That was He'alani Sonopale of the Kalahui Hawaii Political Action Committee. We also talked to Hawaii Mayor Kimo Alameda, who questioned how funding the Magellan Telescope in Chile and not the one in Hawaii helps to make America great again.
That was shocked and a bit disappointed, just because, you know, it's not just the 30-meter telescope. It was also Keck Observatory and some other telescopes, even the one on Maui, the Daniel Inouye Telescope. And, you know, this is a blow to science, but I also felt it's a blow to Hawaii and also, from my standpoint, the Native Hawaiian.
Explain.
So, because, you know, I've always felt like the 30-meter telescope, while it's really good for science, I saw it also as a leveraging tool, something that we could utilize to help us negotiate, to make the mountain better. You know, that's my whole take. And that's why I was a protector, still a protector, but I was up there in 2019 because I didn't like how it all played out. So that's why I like the new version, though. So this new version, one, it has an authority made up of mostly Native Hawaiians. You know, our conversations has been healthy. We share perspectives that are different, but we share it respectfully. And I felt like we were moving in the right direction around coming to a consensus of what we feel would be a good plan for the mountain. And the 30-meter telescope was, I felt, part of that plan because it allows us to negotiate. So if you want the 30-meter telescope, then you're going to have to decommission. If you want the 30-meter telescope, then you're going to have to make sure that the aquifer is protected and cultural sites are preserved and endangered species are acknowledged. And, you know, this 30-meter telescope will also help to provide leverage in getting the other telescopes to pay rent, because this is the only telescope that pays rent and they're not even on the mountain yet. So it's like, I feel like we lost a bargaining chip, you know? And so my whole thing of being on the authority is like, I wanted to just share my perspective that the 30-meter telescope does allow us to make the mountain better, because I haven't seen any other plan to make it better right now. And so I'm just going off of what I know. And that's why I was disappointed. So it just goes back to the status quo. What's the leveraging to decommission now? And the decommissioning in itself, it provides a lot of jobs for the contractors, you know, carpenters and laborers and electricians and iron workers and haulers. I was just disappointed because I felt like, you know, we threw the baby out with the bathwater.
So if this was a deal in the making, it just kind of got cut short.
Well, you know, I'm one of 11 perspectives, right, on the authority, and that would be my narrative. I don't know about the other authority members. You know, they all have their different perspectives on how to make the mountain better. Well, that was my way of making the mountain better, is utilizing the 30-meter telescope as a bargaining chip, if you will, like it should. You know, I always felt best mountain, best science, and that would require some compromise. And unfortunately, now I feel like I have that. So I wonder how we're going to move forward as an authority without that in the mix. I'm very sensitive to the Kia'i's perspective, too. Like I said, I'm a protector just like them. I don't know what their plan is to make the mountain better unless they're thinking remove all telescopes. And then how does that make Hawaii better? I'm a Hawaiian, too. I've always asked, you know, what is it going to take to bring back? There's 650,000 Hawaiians living outside of Hawaii, you know, and what is it going to take to bring them back? Like, as mayor, who is Native Hawaiian, I'm looking for every opportunity to bring them back. Is less telescopes on the mountain going to bring them back? You know, I mean, I don't know. And so, for me, I'm trying to create economic opportunity for Native Hawaiians and utilize the revenues that would come from this compromise to the Native Hawaiian communities, to the homesteads, to the charter schools, to the immersion program. And that's another negotiation that I would push for. So unless, you know, I can hear another plan on how to make the mountain better, if it's just total decommission all telescopes, I don't think that's going to work either.
That was Mayor Kimo Alameda, who we talked to yesterday afternoon. And Ke Aloha Peshauta, president of the group Mauna Kea Aina Ho, says, since learning of the decision on Friday, members of the community have been going up to the mountain to give thanks.
I felt very thankful and blessed that they made that decision. I want to say that it was largely really a function of all of the work that the Kia'i had been doing throughout the years, including building alliances and networks in California that could show up to the university and talk to them about the impacts to not only our land, but our people. And yeah, so I am feeling thankful. I do know that there are a lot of other issues that are stacking up on us, including the long-term leases for both Mauna Kea and Puakaloa. So So those are next on the list, but trying to just maintain our aina and protect the interests of the Hawaiian people in general and the public as well.
And TMT says while they're disappointed, you know, they still are hopeful and will stay the path.
Well, what they're in is a lot of work because their permit is expired. They need a new one. They would have to go through the whole process again that we went through, right? We were all a part of the contested case hearings and environmental review, historic preservation, 106 consultations. I mean, their own news reporting is that they have halted that 106 consultation, but those are requirements under the law. The whole fight has been to maintain the requirements under the laws of Hawaii and the federal government. So that's what we've been fighting for.
We did talk to the mayor, and mm-hmm. he feels that he was hopeful that somehow this project could be used to make Mauna Kea better as leverage.
Well, if he's saying that, he ought to talk with the Kia'i. I mean, he went on live television in the Oha Mayor's Forum and basically called himself a Kia'i. And if that's true, then he ought to be talking to the Kia'i rather than, I don't know who's talking to TMT representatives who don't actually have a good handle on Hawaii law. They've also suggested building it elsewhere, not that we are trying to push it elsewhere, but the question really comes down to, you know, asking anyone who wants to support the science what difference in science it's going to bring. We already have exceeded Mauna Kea's carrying capacity a long, long time ago. And bringing up the TMT and bringing up building an 18-story, 9 football field footprint on the Mauna doesn't impress us in that way. You know what I'm saying? In the name of science, who is benefiting from it? It's not the Hawaiian people. You know, it's not Hawaii either.
That was Mauna Kea Aina Ho President Kealoha Peshkota. The Mauna Kea Authority is expected to take up the issue at its meeting next week, Thursday. In the meantime, we'd like to know what you think about the latest developments. We heard from the Big Island about the loss. Here's a voicemail left on our talkback line.
Hi, this is Brad in Koloko Kona. I was going to say I'm sad about the 30-meter telescope because of the laser pointer, but on the BBC last night was Chile's world's largest camera, and the new telescope is really good at spotting asteroids. Well, maybe we don't need it, even though I would love to have it. It does cost a lot of money, and maybe we don't need it now. We have the space telescope and the Chilean telescope, and all is good, I guess, once they catch those asteroids. Aloha.
Thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or call our talkback line 808-792-8217.
Hea ha ia na o mauna kea, ua hiwi alo pune ke keha.
This Saturday, Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents Honolulu Jazz Quartet. Enjoy live performances with HPR every Saturday in June. Learn more at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Today on The Daily, it's now conventional wisdom that Donald Trump has transformed American politics, but a county-by-county voting analysis from The Times, covering the last 4 presidential races, shows just how drastically Trump has changed the electoral map. I'm Michael Barbaro. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30, following Marketplace.
The Honolulu Police Commission meets tomorrow. It will likely talk about the surprise announcement that its chief, Joe Logan, will retire at the end of the month. Honolulu Civil Beat's Madeline Valera joins us to talk about this latest development. Good morning.
Morning. How are you?
Good, good. So I snuck a quick peek at the agenda, and, you know, on there is the chief's evaluation.
Yes. So they're probably going to be talking about the chief's performance, you know, over the 3 years that he's been chief here in Honolulu. But yesterday was the big announcement that he's going to be stepping down at the end of the month. The mayor has already recommended that the Big Island chief, Ben Moskowitz, come in to serve as interim chief. So, of course, that will need to be confirmed by the commission before that is official. So they may be talking about that as well.
Yeah, and he was one of the finalists in the last go-around before the commission selected Logan.
Yes, he was. And he had worked in Honolulu as an officer for about 22 years himself. So he's familiar with the department and, you know, he knows the area. So, and from what I've heard from the mayor on the Big Island, Chief Moskowitz was very excited about this. It was something that he had wanted, an aspiration of his. So I think that he's excited about the potential opportunity to come back to Honolulu and possibly serve as chief here.
Yeah, but then that leaves a puka for the island of Hawaii.
Yes, definitely. Then they'll, you know, have to do their own process to get a new chief over there as well. So a lot of movement happening.
Well, so for our listeners who may not have heard about how this all came down, you know, what exactly happened yesterday?
Yeah, I think it was a surprise for a lot of people. The Honolulu Police Commission itself didn't know that this was coming, although the chair told me that they had been hearing rumors that the chief might be getting ready to step down, but they didn't hear anything official until after the chief had a meeting with the mayor yesterday, and that's when the decision was made. The mayor then held a press conference in his office. He said, you know, that his meeting with the chief was amicable, that they came to an agreement together for, you know, Chief Logan to retire. But the mayor also said this was something they'd been discussing for quite some time, although he wouldn't say exactly how long they'd been discussing this.
And the mayor, there had been some tension between the mayor and the chief on a number of things. I think, you know, the concern about transparency and, you know, there was that latest a lawsuit that was filed by the ACLU over the DUI arrests?
Yes. Yeah, that was something that became big news recently. And the mayor, yeah, he's been talking about this for, you know, more than a year, about the department's sort of lack of communication with his office and with the public. He has called out the chief on a couple of occasions for not, you know, letting his office know of things that have happened and not communicating better with the media and better with the public. And then, of course, this lawsuit filed by the ACLU on behalf, it's a class action lawsuit on behalf of, they say, hundreds of drivers who were pulled over by Honolulu police officers at sobriety checkpoints or for other minor traffic infractions and actually being arrested for driving under the influence when, you know, a breathalyzer test showed they had no alcohol in their system. You know, they were passing their roadside sobriety tests. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that lawsuit as well. And I think that's also going to be a topic of discussion at the commission meeting tomorrow.
Yeah, and there was some concern also about the vacancies, right? I mean, we're just short hundreds of officers, you know, but I don't know if the mayor thought that maybe the chief didn't do enough to address that problem.
Yes, that's just been an ongoing major, major issue. The chief has repeatedly said that that's been one of his primary goals, to better staff the agency, but it just hasn't been working out. You know, Bobby Cavaco, the president of the State Police Union, said yesterday in a statement that the vacancies in the department have grown 42% over the last 3 years. So, and now they have 228 officers who are eligible for retirement. So those vacancies could stand, you know, to grow much more very soon. And something that the union has also said is they want to see a focus not only on recruitment, but also on retention, because it's been an issue with experienced officers leaving the force, you know, as soon as they're eligible for retirement. So they want to see more incentives done to try to keep those officers on longer. So, yeah, so they feel that the chief, you know, just hadn't done enough in that area.
Well, I'm sure it will be an interesting meeting tomorrow and see what the commission members, you know, divulge about what they knew or didn't know.
Yes, yeah, it will definitely be interesting. And it'll be interesting to hear, too, the timeline of, you know, when we'll see Chief Moskowitz potentially coming, you know, when they'll be confirming him as interim chief, and then what they'll say about the process of, you know, bringing on a new permanent chief.
Right, but there is some concern that that decision should maybe lie with the commission and not so much with the mayor, but yeah, I guess that's to be determined.
Yeah, well, that decision, yeah, currently lies with the commission, but that's something that the mayor has been talking about changing, that he wants to have, you know, more of a say over hiring the police chief, or wants the position of the mayor to have that power, so.
Yeah, well, stay tuned. But thanks so much, Madeline.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
That was reporter Madeline Valera talking to us about the surprise announcement that Honolulu's police chief, Joe Logan, is set to retire. You can read her story at civilbeat.org. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, time for your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukauai, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaii.
To mark the year of our community forests, we're partnering with Trees for Honolulu's Future to bring you trivia based on native plants. The 130,000-acre Parker Ranch was founded in 1847 by John Palmer Parker, with land granted to him by Kamehameha I after helping the monarch domesticate wild cattle. That's because when British Captain George Vancouver first brought bulls and cows to Hawaii in 1793, they were placed under a kapu to protect them and allow them to reproduce. No one could harm them. Over subsequent decades, their increasing populations had negative impacts on farmlands, landscapes, and upland forests. That led to the kings bringing in foreigners to teach the Hawaiians how to control cattle in the early 1800s, which laid the foundation for Parker Ranch and later led to one of the first environmental conservation laws in Hawaii's history, the Act for the Protection and Preservation of Woods and Forests. For today's backyard quiz, do you know the name of the Hawaiian monarch that signed that act into law? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag and a brand new deck of Trees for Honolulu's Future card game, Kumula'au.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Hawaii Public Radio is here for you and with you. HPR's Live from the Atherton series brings our community together with stories and music that make Hawaii, Hawaii. Support community and unity with HPR. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art with HOMA Nights, open until 9 p.m. Fridays for art experiences, talks, live music, and dining. HonoluluMuseum.org.
You know, while HPR's Derek Malama was getting settled into his shift at the station very early this morning, we happened to be out in Waikiki. At 3 a.m., we got the chance to observe a homeless count. It's a survey that the Waikiki Business Improvement District has been tracking since 2006. The numbers are shared with the city and state, and the state usually works with the nonprofit Partners in Care for the annual point-in-time count. This year, it announced it would do its count in the homeless shelters, but would not be out in the field, as it's not a requirement for this year. So the data point provided by the survey is helpful. Honolulu Patrol officers and outreach workers accompany the University of Hawaii urban planning students as they gather out front of the Waikiki Police Substation. Organizers hand out flashlights and they give last-minute instructions as teams of six split up to cover the territory from the Alawai Boat Harbor to Kapi'olani Park and everything in between.
Thank you all for coming. We're going to get started now. We're just a couple minutes over, but my name is Dave Morosco. I'm the one who organizes this project for UH. My boss is Carl Kim. He is the one who has procured this project for us. I'm sure you're familiar with most of us by now, but some of us are new, and we're all going to be doing our best to count the individuals in Waikiki that are sleeping outside of homes. And we all have the information that we need to do this job. And all that we ask is that as we collaborate with you, you try to answer any questions we might have about the people we're observing, because I don't think we know them as well as you do. We've gone over all the coding. Any questions you guys have, call me, please. Anything you need to do. Some of you will be walking. Some of you will be driving in vehicles with the police. And officers, if you would, if you feel like there are any areas where our technicians should get out and walk to get better observations, please let them know. Please feel free to stop and let them out and tell them where they should look for these people that might otherwise go unobserved. So the coding is this. When you write on the map for our technicians, it's three-digit codes. There's a number, a letter, and a letter. So it goes number, so usually one. Male or female or unknown. You can put unknown if you're really not sure what the gender is and you can't get any assistance from your partners about who this might be. And then, of course, the age group. There are four age groups: C for child, 0 to 12, Y for youth, 13 to 25, adult is 26 to 65, elderly is E, and that is 60 over 65. You are also free to put unknown for age if you really think you cannot discern the age group, but we try to discourage that, try to make as good guesses as possible. Finally, if you see people in a car, put a box around the people that are in the car. If it's a family of people that you think are together for survival reasons, put a circle around them. Of course, if you see multiple people in a car, that's probably automatically a circle and a box around it. Okay, that's it. Please write as legibly as you can. Use your flashlights. If there are any inconsistencies or any problems, we'll just look over the maps after you're done. All right? Everybody know their route number?
Yes.
Every route map? Okay, let's commence.
And our team covers an area from Fort Drusy Beach down to Kapahulu and the Alawai. I was pleasantly surprised that very few homeless were asleep on the beach. Urban planning professor Carl Kim says over the nearly two decades that he's been walking around this area, the numbers have fluctuated, and they are down by about 11% in the urban core and down 18% in the adjacent areas. We survey the beach fronting the Royal Hawaiian Hotel and the recently constructed beach groin to deal with beach erosion.
It really depends. I mean, I think there was a big impact when they closed the beach, right? Prior to that, this would be kind of an ideal location, right? Because it's flat, more accessible.
And you said the last time you were here, there were how many congregating in this area?
Oh, I think there was at least 15 in this whole area. I'll have to look again, but I do remember that over by that wall there was a large cluster.
But maybe because of the groin work?
Yeah, possibly, or because of the bad weather that we've had, or other factors.
And Trevor Abuzia is the president of the Waikiki Business Improvement District. He believes the reduced numbers are in part thanks to the teams of ambassadors that are dispatched to patrol the area.
So we have a team of overnight ambassadors that go out, and it's a team of three. And we have two safety ambassadors and then one outreach ambassador or worker. And what they do is the Kuhio Beach Park closes at midnight. So when it closes at midnight, no one's allowed to sleep in the park. So that team goes out and lets those people know. say, hey, you cannot be here, you cannot sleep here, but they're not just going to kick them out or push them out. We offer services right away. So whether it's transport to IHS shelter, whether it's medical attention, or if they want to be connected, maybe it's not right in that moment, but they want to be connected to a caseworker, then we'll connect them with our daytime team of social workers and street medicine workers that are able to get them the help they need. So I think that's where we're seeing this drastic reduction in homelessness in Waikiki because of kind of the investments we're making on the outreach side, but also the safety side with these ambassadors.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty remarkable. I expected far more people on the beach.
Yeah, me too. And there used to be, you know, probably about 2 years ago, before Safe and Sound started and coming out of the pandemic, you know, we used to have dozens and dozens of people on the beach. And now, you know, as we're seeing, probably only a handful, which is really promising. And I think the numbers too show that we're getting the people into shelter or into medical attention. They're really co-aligned with the drastic reduction in homelessness. So it's a really exciting time. And we're only, you know, getting started, in my opinion. I think that there's a lot more we can invest in and a lot more work that we could do in Waikiki on this front.
And today's unofficial count was 159, down from 184 about 6 months ago. The city's new homeless services coordinator, Roy Miyahara, took the time today to come out in the field and join the count. He hopes this effort by the Waikiki Business District can be used as a model for other communities across Oahu.
Happy to be part of this first time and doing a point-in-time type of count. And really being on the ground for 2-3 hours and following the people who have a lot of know-how, really kind of understanding as to what people are like when they're homeless, whether it's on the beach or having to find a spot deep into a corner or even in the bushes. It's, again, it breaks your heart to see folks who just don't have the help at this point. But I like the fact that there's some outreach at the same time, not just counting and offering some services and even saying hello, getting them to talk a little bit about where they are.
And I don't know, anything surprised you this morning?
No, being in big cities and seeing a little bit of that in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and San Jose, I wouldn't say so. Well, maybe the big surprise is in those big cities are a lot more shoulder-to-shoulder type of people who are experiencing homelessness. Here, we're walking for 10 minutes not seeing another person. So it's very encouraging to see numbers that go from maybe 41 to maybe a raw number of 37 this morning in our district. I'm very happy to see what Trevor's done.
And then, I don't know, this idea of actually getting the community energized to do something like this, I don't know.
Yeah, my thought behind that is talk to neighborhood boards. I'd love for them to come out and see this once every 6 months and generate that type of excitement that I've seen in neighborhood boards and actually do an operation like this. Because there's a lot of good community outreach. There's a lot of good hearts who want to do something like this. It's just a matter of, I think, just executing behind it. I think Waikiki is showing that there's a lot of model of success here and a lot of best practices that I think every neighborhood should keep an eye on. We want this thing, this part of the city too, because we have a strategic plan and Waikiki just folds right into it.
And that was a snapshot of a homeless survey conducted between 3 and 5 a.m. this morning. And we got extra early, so you didn't have to. It was an opportunity to bring you out into Waikiki to share what's underway in our community. And now it's time for us to provide the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier, we asked for the name of the monarch who signed into law one of the first environmental conservation laws in Hawaii's history. The Act for the Protection and Preservation of Woods and Forests became law in September 1876 to preserve the kingdom's water resources by protecting Hawaii's upland forests and watersheds. Many of those areas had been shrinking due to the growing cattle industry, ranches clearing land to create pastures for grazing livestock. The sandalwood trade also led to the decimation of forested acres, with the Apuaha land management system collapsing due to the Great Mahele and population loss due to smallpox. The monarch at the time made an attempt at environmental conservation by signing the Act for Protection and Preservation of Woods and Forests into law.
That monarch was King David Kalakaua, which is the answer to today's backyard quiz. That's our quiz. We had no winners today. We stumped you on that one. But if you have an idea to share, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Winner picks up trees for Honolulu's Futures card game, Kumulaau. We're enjoying giving out these card decks, and recently we got this feedback on our recent backyard quizzes featuring the Milo plant. Here's what one caller remembers about growing up.
Ke Anoa'i, calling from Moku o Kiawe, and of course, I didn't get the answer right as the Milo tree, but as soon as you said color-changing flowers, pua, I remember when Grandma used to tell us, everybody better be back home by the time the hau flowers turn orange. And that's from Kohala, Hawaii Island, also known as Moku o Kiawe.
HPR Generation Listens Trivia is moving to a new night. Join us on the first Tuesday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. We'll share an evening of lively but friendly competition while connecting with fellow public radio nerds. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
New York City has lost control of its jails. In May, a federal judge ruled that the city's jails, including Rikers Island, will now be run by a manager who reports directly to the court.
The city, over the past decade, at just about every turn, has failed to implement reforms, and the violence in the meantime has actually worsened.
The federal takeover of Rikers Island. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
A new play just opened at Kumukahua Theater. The Golden Gaze by Ryan Okinaka is a homage to the long-running television show The Golden Girls. The show closes out the theater's 54th season and arrives just in time for Pride Month. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson sat down with the playwright, along with Alexis Drain, one of the actors in the show. Okinaka begins by talking about how the idea for the play first came to him.
I happened to be just getting ready for the day on a Sunday morning, and I heard sounds coming from my brother's bedroom. And I peeked in, and it was the Golden Girls. He was watching the Golden Girls. And I thought, yeah, if ever there was a perfect play to write that my brother would love, it would be a play inspired by the Golden Girls. And then I knew that I also wanted to write a play that was a love letter to the queer community, and to be able to dive into the complexities of my culture, the queer culture. So really it was just a combination of writing a play that was inspired by the Golden Girls and also combining all of my love and experience being a gay man in the gay community.
I'll never forget, I had an old roommate who was always playing the Golden Girls. He'd come home from long days of work and just play a few episodes. And I said to him, why are you always playing the Golden Girls? And he said, it's comfort. The ladies are going to always be safe down in Florida no matter what happens.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know, why do you think that show persists across generations apparently? Why does it remain a viable pop culture touchstone?
Yeah, it's crazy. When I started writing the play, I don't know that I truly understood what the Golden Girls meant to the queer community. I knew that a lot of gays, right? A lot of my people love the Golden Girls, and I didn't necessarily understand why until I started to just watch episode after episode. And I was like, oh my God, these ladies are just drag queens, like reading each other every minute and every second that they have a chance to read each other. That would just whip each other with these great insults, but they're all somehow rooted in love, and you never think that they hate each other. They're just like, they just love each other so much that they're comfortable to be able to do these things and to be able to like insult each other and tease each other like that. And then beyond just that, the topics that the show hit upon at such a early time in our history was groundbreaking. They were not afraid to push the boundaries. They were not afraid to be old. They were not afraid to discuss topics about the LGBT community, which at the time, right, was just unheard of in media. It means a lot to the queer community to be able to have had something so early in history shine a light on our experiences and our stories as queer men.
And so that's the point of inspiration, a starting point for this project. Tell us a little bit more about how you molded that starting point into the story.
Yeah, so I knew that I wanted each of the Golden Girls, but I wanted to reimagine them as a queer character. So I'll start with like Sophia, right? So Sophia is the oldest in the family. And in my play, Sophia is called Auntie Mary, and she's a retired drag queen. She's also transgender. And at a very young age, her nephew lost his parents and she adopted the nephew. So the nephew is called Tommy and he is based off of Dorothy. So they are like a mother and son relationship. And Tommy is he's a divorcee. He was married to a woman for 30 years and had a daughter. And he's starting to come to terms with his sexuality, divorced his wife, and he's trying to navigate this phase in his life and trying to come out of the closet as a queer man. And then there's Betty White's character, Rose. Rose, in my play, is called Jimmy. He's a transplant from the mainland who married a Chinese guy here in Hawaii. And it's just like Rose, naive and goes on in these long, nonsensical stories about this imaginary place, which in my play is St. Oakley. But in The Golden Girls, it's St. Olaf. Unfortunately, his partner passes away about a year prior to the play starting. So he's navigating his grief and the opportunity of new love, which he may or may not be ready for. And then the Blanche character in my play is called Anue Nue, and he is a retired choreographer. And he's just as promiscuous as Blanche was in The Golden Girls. He is presented with new love also, but that new love may not be in for the right intentions, and he may be getting taken advantage of. So yeah, so that's the basic of all the characters. So Tommy has an ex-wife who, in The Golden Girls, Dorothy had an ex-husband named Stan, and Stan would always come to the doors, and he'll always announce himself as, "Hey, hi, it's me, Stan." So yeah, so we have that character in the play. Her name is Crystal, and every time she walks through the doors, she jingles her keys, and she says, "Hi, I'm Crystal." And they have a daughter, which is Kelsey, who Alexis plays. And it's a very interesting dynamic between the three of them because it's a divorce story, but it's also a coming out story. You've got the two parents who are constantly bickering and trying to figure out what their future holds. And you've got this daughter who is somehow this beacon of light that is able to bring them together and to navigate that path in order for them all to move forward.
Alexis, tell us about your character. What do you want audiences to understand about her?
So actually, it's crazy. I was thinking about it. And recently, I realized that Kelsey, my character, she not only is trying to, like Oki said, navigate bringing the family or the parents together, but also creating a space where this is like the new normal and we're family, we still have to navigate through that. But I also think that her main focus is letting her dad know that he's accepted and that she's there with him on this journey, and that no matter what he does, she will always be there. Because that's pretty much what she does. It's almost like she's there with him during really pivotal parts of him learning new things. And at the end of the play, I won't give too much away, but it's just her like, "I love you, we're here, we're together, you gotta do what you gotta do, no matter what, and I'll still be here."
I've known Alexis for years, she's one of my closest friends, and as I was writing the play, I was writing the character with her in mind. The play is about friendship, and Alexis is one of my closest friends, so as I was writing, a lot of our experiences and Alexis's influence on my life was infused into the story of the play.
You said the show's about friendship. I think it's about family, and maybe more specifically about chosen family, people given to us not by biology, but by life experience. Talk more about that idea of chosen family.
Yeah. So in the queer community, I mean, my personal story is very different from a lot of the common heartbreaking stories within the queer community. A common thread is a child will come out to their family, and the family will disown them for whatever reason, and he or she will be on their own, and they'll find a community that will take them in, that becomes their chosen Ohana. That storyline, that theme is very prevalent within our story. It's very prevalent within the community. So it's so relatable and it's such a beautiful thing. I don't know that if you're not quite part of the queer community that you can truly understand the importance of what that means to be in the chosen Ohana. It's different when you have been casted aside by your family, your blood relatives, thinking that you have nothing in this world, and complete strangers who just know your experience and know you better than you know yourself, yeah, they see something in you and they see that you need to be loved and supported and they take you in. It's just a different type of family and it's a different type of love. And I hope that this play touches upon what that means for people who are not quite familiar with that idea of chosen Ohana. It's just really important to the queer community. And if you're lucky enough to be part of that.
Well, and there's an irony there too, because we might spend lots of time with a biological family with siblings and parents who don't have that shorthand you just spoke of. And you can meet someone and within a few minutes have that shorthand. That's meaningful. That's powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think about my own family. I love my family. No one disowned me for my life choices. But I'm also, we're a very Asian household, right? And a thing with Asian families is we tend to not talk about things. And we tend to not necessarily verbalize our love. You put a pot of rice on the table, that's love. But we're not going to tell each other, okay, bye, mom, love you. We just don't do stuff like that, right? So I'm not necessarily expressive when I'm at home or with my family. I don't know that they truly know the real Oki necessarily. But my friends do. So when I'm with my friends and when I'm with my chosen Ohana, I am a different person. I'm a truer version of who I am just because I feel more comfortable to be my true self. I say it often, I feel like Alexis probably knows me more than my brother does sometimes just because I'm able to be more expressive and be more true, the true Oki with Alexis than I can with my brother for some reason, which is a whole another play in of itself.
Both meaningful relationships, but just very different. Mm. Differently in your life. Alexis, you've known Oki for a long time. You have worked together many times. Tell me about when he brings you into the process. Did you get a sneak peek at the script ahead of time or do you have to wait for the rehearsal process?
Actually, I was with Oki. So he actually created the draft and it's been about a year or two in the works.
Yeah.
And we would constantly have these little get-togethers at his house and we would just constantly read it for him. So I was in the process.
From the get-go.
Like, yeah, from the
inception
the get-go.
Of the idea,
yeah,
probably. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's a big gift to a playwright, to be able to hear the work out loud really helps you understand what you've done.
Yeah, for sure. I tend to write for actors and I tend to write an actor with their voice in mind because it just helps to flesh out the character. I already had Alexis in mind, so it was very easy and very, very much a blessing to have a chosen Ohana that also supports my art for me to just be like, hey, I have something. I have 15 pages. Let's get together and let's just read. And yeah, that's how it was built.
Well, you two are both very young, but you've already known each other for a long time, gotten older together. Play has a lot to say about aging, right?
Yes,
it figures.
Yes.
So tell us how that theme figures into the story.
Yeah, we're not that old. Even though we feel like we are sometimes, we're not. However, we can start to relate to what it feels like to get old. And I think a theme that I really like in this play is that no one is in their last chapter. You may feel like you're in your last chapter, but I think that's just your own personal perception. Everyone has tons of life to live so long as they're breathing. An important thing that I got from the Golden Girls is that none of those ladies felt like they were on their last chapter. And I think we often think about the fact that we get to a different decade in our life, right? And we think, okay, our time is coming. Let's get ready to go for whatever reason. But I think it's important for us to know that every moment that we're on this earth with breath in our lungs, we should be living to the fullest. We should be pursuing each and every dream that we have, regardless of how old we are.
Yeah, see what you're capable of. It reminds me of Satchel Paige, who is a baseball pitcher, spent most of his life playing in the Negro Leagues, made it to the major leagues when he was 50 years old. People kept fixating on that fact. And he stuck by the statement, how old would you be if you didn't know how old you are? And it's that sense of what's possible, what do I want to make possible, and just trying it, trying to do it. Oki, you wrote that the play is a love letter to the queer community, to drag, to survival, and to messy, joyful power of chosen family.
Yes.
Say more about that.
I just think there's so much about the queer community, specifically here in Hawaii, that's so beautiful and so different from the mainland. And it's so rich and we're so inviting that I really wanted to just create something that allowed me to make my mark to say what I wanted to say and to thank this community for being so open and inviting and inclusive.
Alexis, it's a dynamic cast of characters, as we've been talking about, a lot of themes packed into the show. But when audience members walk out of the theater, what do you hope is front and center in their memory of what they've just experienced?
I hope that when they leave the theater, they know that it's never too late and that family, no matter what, chosen or just regular ohana, is everything. The people who you have around you definitely is a reflection of who you are as a person as well. So you keep the people who
lift you up.
Yeah, who lift you up and build you up and all this kinds of stuff. If you keep them with you, like, it'll reflect in your everyday.
And that was playwright Ryan Oginaka and actress Alexis Drain. They spoke with HPR's G.W. Gibson about the new play, The Golden Gaze, which just opened at Kumukahua Theater. Find a link to showtimes and tickets on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down the road.
Well, that does it for us today. Tomorrow, we plan to talk to the executive director of the Mauna Kea Authority. What happens to TMT now? Board members are to meet next week. Share your comments or questions about the project. Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also find the conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.